Possession crucial from this. How much longer will the referee allow? Dublin lead by a point. And there's the whistle. It's over. It's over.
We earned it by winning the last two matches on the road. And that's not going to be taken away from us.
But what I love in hurling, I love players that will never give in.
He hits it. He hits it. It's over the bar.
Hello there, my name is Des Cahill and you're very welcome to the RTE GAA podcast. Now this week I'm joined as usual by my colleague Peter Sweeney from RTE Online Sport, by Emma Duffy of the42.ie and Cork Hurling's Donald Cusick. Now amongst the topics we'll be discussing today, coping with the build-up to an All-Ireland final, we'll be looking at the under-20 hurling final between Tip and Cork and the big ladies football semi-final doubleheader in Croke Park. But we're going to start with you, Donald, and reflections on the All-Ireland Senior Hurling Final. This week I'm reading the papers and people are talking about the depth in the Tipperary squad and the young players coming through, and Tip can, you know, go on to dominate for a few years. But in a way, this gets written almost every year after a team wins, doesn't it?
Yeah, Des, look, it's part and parcel for the week after a victory in an All-Ireland Final that you hear talk of domination. Everything for the victors is rosy, and for the losers there's seems to be many questions posed over them, and I think that's just par for the course. But like in reality, even when you look at Tipperary, you know, and people talking about, you know, their under-20s are in the final, they've won the senior, even retaining the All-Ireland Hurling Championship has proved very difficult over the years. And because maybe Kilkenny have been so successful, we've lost sight of that fact, Des. And like, I think that there's actually only five teams in the game have retained the All-Ireland title. And outside of the big three, Wexford and Galway were the other two, and they've only done it once. And in fact, the big three have failed to do it more often than they've actually been successful at it. And even if you look to 12 months ago, I suppose all of the talk was around, you know, and rightly so, how fantastic Limerick were, how young they were, the potential they had for the future. But like, you know, you move on 12 months, I think it's now proven again how difficult it is. Back in February, I think we were talking, and I was making the point that whilst Limerick were worthy champions, that they would find it hard to retain the title. And the point, I suppose, that I was making was that it's such fine margins. And the example I used was the last 10 minutes of the All-Ireland semi-final against Cork. You had Nicky Quaid's fantastic save, but you'd also certain bounces of the ball and certain decisions that went Limerick's way, that over the course of a full season, it was very hard to see maybe a break not going their way. And I know it's easy to talk about it in retrospect, but even if you look back at the All-Ireland semi-final and that last sideline, you know, proved that. So whilst, yes, there is loads of talk about Tipperary and loads of positive talk, and rightly so, there is no guarantee of success in the future.
I think probably Tipperary might have a better chance, say, than Limerick of retaining it, because they have the knowledge of this before. You know, a lot of these guys, a third of the team won an All-Ireland in 2010, lost the final,
but they didn't win in 2011.
They lost the final, yeah, by 4 points. Then they won in 2016, and the immediate talk after from Michael Ryan and the players, the Tipperary players in 2016, was the talk about the need or the want to go back to back, and obviously that didn't happen either. They lost by a point as well, so it was pretty close. But I think these players, they've been through this before. They'll celebrate it, of course, but they'll put themselves, I think, in a good position to actually retain it, because they have been through this before. They have some younger players, but for the most part, the backbone of the team is in and around the 30 mark. You know, Paddy Maher, Noel McGrath is only 28, Brendan Maher, players like that.
But was there not a concern, Peter, that this Tip team might be getting on too much, that it was getting too old, and now suddenly they're 30 is a good age to retain?
Well, if they'd lost, they might have been too old, but the fact that they've won it, I think it means they're all going to stay around. I think if you lose another All-Ireland final, lads probably start scratching their head and thinking, is it time to call it a day? But I don't think anyone will walk away at this stage. Then, of course, and we'll come to it later on, they've a pretty good under-20 team as well, a couple of good young players that'll maybe one or two of them might be in the team next year, which will make them that bit better. You know, someone like Jake Morris. I don't know what you think, Emma, but I think they're in a pretty good shape. I'm not saying they are going to retain it, but
yeah, I think so too. I think it's been brilliant, I suppose, to see that team has kind of nearly come up the whole way. And you know, they started out with Sheedy at underage, and then obviously 2010, and then we saw the scenes obviously on Sunday and how much it meant. I think one thing that really stood out to me, I suppose, was at the final whistle when Liam Sheedy went over to his family, and I thought that was just an exceptional moment, and it showed all that's good in the GAA, I think. So things like that, yeah, obviously to see how much it meant to Seamus Callanan afterwards, his interview and what he said, and then just the pictures afterwards, it was immense. So yeah, you'd hope that, you know, they can carry it on into next year, and as you say, with those under 20 lads coming through, they're in good stead.
But part of the argument against this case is that really this season showed, did it not, Dunlough, that there's very little between the teams in Munster, very little between the teams in Leinster. I mean, it could, you know, it's going to be a very open championship next year, you'd have to say, based on that.
Absolutely, Des, and I think that's something we should be all very happy about as hurling followers. And I think, like, even following on from Peter's and Emma's point there around the whole, you could see the emotional release that was there after the game last Sunday. Like, a huge part of that is the amount of effort and time, and Liam mentioned it, the sacrifice that's involved to actually be the person that comes out on those fine margins. So, like, that's easier said than done also. You know, there's a reason why Tipperary won the All-Ireland this year, and part of that is that, you know, I suppose, unbelievable commitment that's required, and they'll know better than anybody, if they are to climb that mountain again in the coming season, that they'll have to be equally as committed, if not more so, given the way that the standard and the requirements of sport change on a yearly basis.
Dunlough, you won your first All-Ireland in 99 and then you won it again in 04. Was there anything different between what you did after 99 and, say, after 04 in terms of...
Because they did retain it.
Because you did retain it then in 05.
I'd say potentially looking back, right, and it's always easier looking back to the best strategies are written looking backward, as we all know, folks. But I would say in 99, I remember a huge, like, it was a young Cork team. Cork hadn't won the All-Ireland in 9 years. I think it was 1990 to 99 was the gap. And, like, it was a huge, huge celebrations. And, like, often that can be maybe missed outside of the counties. Like, the excitement now that will be in Tipperary. On Monday they had their homecoming. I know in Cork it was tradition on the Tuesday night that you bring it to the captain's club. But right throughout the winter, you want to show respect and, I suppose, involve everybody that's part of that community, be that schools, hospitals, families, all the different clubs. So, like, and rightly so, because it's such a special thing in a player's and a community's lives, that the cup will go on a serious, serious tour. I would say that when we won in 2004, we had lost the final in 2003, the year before. So we were, if you like, battle hardened and scarred by that experience. And I would say that did stand us in good stead in terms of wanting to retain the title in 05. But again, you've very fine margins when you look back in that season. And we actually ended up playing in four All-Ireland finals in a row, losing at either end and winning the two in the middle. But I would say there was more of a maturity about us by the time we won the 0-4 title. Yes, Peter?
Yeah, there's an interesting story, obviously, this week with Micheál Donoghue stepping down as the Galway manager. Now, last year, Galway very narrowly beaten in the semi-final, and people says, well, the hunger they showed the year before in winning it and the talent was there, and again, young players coming through, and Galway will build on this. Now, again, beaten very narrowly, kind of bizarre fate of results. The night they lost to Dublin, there was a draw in the other game, etc. But he has stepped down now, and people, a bit like Tipperary now, you know, 2 years ago, everyone said, oh, this Galway team are going to be around for a long time. it kind of shows the vagaries and the pressures on it, and maybe the pressures on the manager, Emma, as well.
Yeah, definitely, of course. It's obviously a huge thing to bring a county to an All-Ireland title. And, you know, even if we look back to 2013 and to Clare and the kind of excitement that was built around that young Clare team, and we look at what's happened since, they're still trying to get back to the Holy Grail. So, yeah, there obviously is huge pressure on management. And I think definitely, obviously, Sheedy coming in this year, and there was such hype around that. But then next year, it's can he retain it? Definitely. And can he retain that team? And can they go again?
Yeah, and it shows as well, Peter, maybe the pressure, the time and energy. Like, even some managers are paid, some aren't, but the pressure on them, whether they're paid or not, and time, and if you have a family, it's not easy.
Well, I think the family is a big thing. As far as I know, Micheál has three young kids, which, you know, that's going to take up a lot of your time. He's obviously got his job as well. It's interesting. It's twice as hard almost to win an All-Ireland now than it was. Tip had to win 8 matches this year to win an All-Ireland. Mm-hmm. Kilkenny, in their great days, had to win 4. So, you know, they'd have 2 All-Ireland medals won by this year. And so that alone adds pressure to players and management as well. It's a tough slog. You know yourself when you've stuff going on outside your work and your family that it takes up so much of your time. It must take up so much of your headspace. I think you have to be a very particular type of person who can compartmentalise that, and obviously you need the right sort of people around you that you can delegate to. But yeah, it's a massive job, and it's a massive appointment now for Galway Hurling, because they have got a very good team, but a lot of them, such as, you know, Joe Canning, he's 31 coming, you know, and he is the leading light of the team, as we've seen when they struggled without him this year. It's a pivotal appointment because this team could go into transition very quickly, and you have to start cycling in younger guys. They might be too young. They might need a couple of years to step up. So this is a very, very important appointment for Galway Hurling.
Some of the elements, don't, like, you were involved with the Clare senior hurlers. You could give us an idea. I mean, a manager has to deal with a selective strength and conditioning people, dietitians, you know, individually with players in the squad, and it's a big squad. Talk a little bit about the pressures that a manager would be under that we might not always be aware of.
Yeah, it's a good point, Des. Look, I think we all see the manager on the line and on game day, and we see their interaction with the media, and there's a major amount involved in both of those aspects. But I think the it's the unseen. You might have 40 players on a squad. Maybe you would have a backroom team of anything up to 30. Like, that's a huge organisation that you're taking responsibility for, and even from a player's point of view, you're very conscious and trying to constantly balance the welfare of those players. You're worried about what's going on in their lives, and whilst also trying to push them to the absolute limit of their physical and mental capacity. And I think that's often, you know, it's one of the biggest challenges that managers have, is to actually make that balance. And then even the thaw time, like, you know, I know myself, I always value your thaw time as one of the most valuable aspects of your time. And, you know, most of these managers have other jobs that is obviously taking up a fair amount of their energy, but I'd imagine that every other second of their thaw time is taken up by managing teams. And, like, you look at Michael O'Donoghue, or Micheál O'Donoghue, you know, you go back 12 months ago, we'll call it, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody was talking about Galway being the dominant team, the potential to go on and win. You know, many All-Irelands had superstar, stellar players. And now we see it, you know, maybe not even 13 months beyond the All-Ireland final, that Micheál has resigned. Having said that, I'd imagine when he looks back, right, and this is probably the thing that we're all blinded by the love of this thing so much, I'll never forget the image of Micheál meeting what I think was his father back in Galway with the Liam McCarthy trophy. And I'd imagine, what I know the O'Donoghues and how much they love the game, he was probably happy to make all of those sacrifices. But it's definitely a factor in the that whole management. Like it was, especially if you're going to other counties. I know myself driving, even the drive for 2 hours. I had an extra 2 hours when I was driving to Clare onto the training sessions. And there's very few managers would arrive anything less, or managers or coaches would arrive anything less than 2 hours before a training session. Then you go out and do the training session, maybe last anything from 70 to 90 minutes. But afterwards, again, you've got your review of the session. There's so many things to be done. So it's a huge commitment. It was the point I made about Davey in terms of even him travelling, taking over Wexford was one thing. But even the travel time, Des, between Clare, his home in Clare, to Wexford, it was probably one of the furthest commutes between any hurling counties in the country.
Mm. What time would you have gotten home at to Cork from Clare, roughly?
To be honest, Des, yeah, it would have been late. Like I said, you know, if you're training at 7 o'clock, you're out there 8:30, 9:15, do your review, it'd be off to midnight. Now, I work for a multinational, so I'm used to doing not standard hours, and you know, some of my reports are in different parts of the US and China and Europe, so I'd be used not to doing regular hours. But it's definitely anybody that's entering into that game would want to be very, very, very conscious of it. So it would have been often after midnight would have been the reality, Des, and that would be the same up and down the country. And you even see it now at club level, the demands that are on and expected by players, I suppose, of club level managers, the amount of time. And that's not to mention a person's family. I remember when I was playing that there was very few of us had kids, I would say, at the time, but Brian Corkin was a person I often thought about, and that he had a young family. And I remember thinking from a playing point of view that Brian had a job, he would come home, he would probably maybe not even see the kids, or if he did see him, it would be for a very short time. Then he would go out the door training, and by the time he got home, they were in bed. So it's the same for managers, like that sacrifice that everybody has to make. It's not just the case that it's you making the sacrifice, it's everybody around you, from your family to your friends. And Liam mentioned that support network. That is so critical in any individual's success, that they do have that backing from their immediate circle to help them being a success.
It's interesting, Emma, when you look at it now, in hurling, for instance, Cork, Waterford, Galway, all without a manager, Wexford and Clare not confirmed. Like, that's half of the big counties, basically. Westmeath, Offaly, all need managers. It's becoming a tougher task, isn't it? And the pressure on managers.
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, we've seen over the last few years the hype that comes around managers, and I suppose the negative backlash with it as well. I think I've listened to a few managers speaking about how, you know, it had kind of negative impacts on their family. You know, kids are going into school and they're hearing these things said about their dad, and they don't want to hear it. But we see that in so many managers, I suppose, statements when they leave a setup. You know, they speak about family commitments and the need to kind of put in more time there. I think it was the Meath hurling manager during the week who spoke that his wife can book a holiday now without worrying about fixture clashes. So you do have to look at, I suppose, the person behind the manager, and they all have lives like the rest of us. You know, they obviously, it is a 24/7 job, and it is around the clock. I'd imagine you're up till all hours watching analysis back and whatever. But, you know, for mental health even, I suppose it is nearly important for often just to step away from it and to kind of get yourself right to go again.
Emma makes a fantastic point there, and it was one I tell you that I didn't realise until I went into it. But when she makes that point around the health, it's actually a thing that and maybe I'm just more conscious of it now, but it's a thing that you often see with many coaches, that, you know, you'd be on about putting on a few pounds and stuff like that. Like, I definitely know that, you know, when you are being so conscious of everybody else's well-being, very often it's probably just a human thing. You forget about your own well-being. And I do think it's a big challenge for coaches and managers to actually look after their own physical and mental well-being. So it's a very pertinent point that Emma raises there.
But in doing so, Peter, it does make the case, really, managers should be paid. I know like we're doing somewhere, somewhere in the here.
Well, that's
but, like, it's very hard to be an amateur
in
that.
It is, and it's an issue that hasn't actually raised its head in recent years. You know, the GA, this is something they tackle from time to time under the table payments.
They kind of tackle.
Was it Peter Quinn said they couldn't even find a table the payments were made under? Yeah. But it, of course, it's something I think. It has to be formalised because even at club level, there's managers getting a couple of quid per session or whatever it is per year. There's inter-county managers getting paid in some way, shape or form, whether it be, you know, inflated mileage or whatever it may be. But I think we all know that that's the case. But it should be formalised.
Do you think people have an issue with it? Do you think the majority of GA people have an issue with a manager getting paid?
I don't think so. I think if that manager is literally just taking the money out of the club or the county, that may be an issue, or whether they'd rather to see somebody from inside the club or the county do the job, potentially costing less. That's potentially an issue. But
even, you see, like the point...
I don't think anybody begrudges them a few quid for their time and effort, I suppose, is what I was saying there. Sorry, Des.
But in terms of if a guy or a woman has a family... You've so many nights where you're gone, so that even if you got time off during the day, your kids could be at school or whatever, it's very hard to combine family life and the culture of nighttime training and nighttime.
Well, that's one of the eternal issues with the GAA is the fact that it's a voluntary organisation. So training, meetings, whatever it may be, you know, if you're on a committee rather than training in a team, that all happens in the evening time. So you do what you do during the day and then you head off. And then you do miss out on say family time or whatever it is you could be doing otherwise. And you know, as the demands get greater, it's a bigger ask of people. Mm-hmm. I know, like I'm involved in the committee in my own club, Branagh Gaels, and you know, I'm happy to do it, but it does take up time. And I was secretary. I'm not anymore. I'm very thankful for that. But that's a big job. And
you weren't voted out. I hope at the AGM, were you?
Well, they made me chair, but I think that was just to get me out of the secretary's job. Yeah, I could do less damage probably. But the demands on that increase every year because you know, and rightly so. But things like GDPR and child protection. Now I know we're going a little bit off topic here, but it's a big ask, and it's an issue that the GA are going to have in the future, and that they will have to look at. It's just the demands they put on the volunteers in their organisation. That goes back to managers because again, a lot of them are doing it free gratis and for the love of the sport, club, county, whatever it may be. And you know, my hat goes off to them.
I see, Emma, in Galway, there's talk of the minor manager, recent minor manager, as, you know...
Geoffrey Linsky.
Yeah, and taking over. Is it a big step up, would you think, from minor to senior?
Oh, I'd imagine so, Des. But we look at, you know, there has been success there over the past. The one example that really springs to mind, I suppose, is Peter Keane in his first year with Kerry Footballers this year. And, you know, he's come up with that group and that has worked really well. But then again, yeah, of course, there is that gap between the two. But I suppose like a player, they have to transition. And it's the same with a manager.
Yeah. Well, let's not forget Jim Gavin came straight from under 20.
Under 21, which is different to under 17, isn't it?
Well, it is, yeah. That's is true.
4 years is a huge.
It is a change. Obviously, they changed those grades in the last couple of years. But Geoffrey Linsky is with the Galway 20s. He's gone from the minors to the 20s, and he's the front runner. But I suppose you have to learn your trade some way, and sure. Make the step up. And some, no more than players, some are able to make it straight away, and some of them never will, and some of them just need a couple of years.
Yeah,
you know. So,
John Logue, what's your view on that?
Yeah, like Des, I think it's hard to know which is the best route in, right? But I definitely would say that there's a big difference between under 17 and under 20, and what was the old minor and under 21. When I suppose when players are getting to that stage of 21, there, you know, a lot of players that are actually part of the senior squads. But I think it can't be a hindrance anyway, is what I would say, of having that experience of managing. I would say though, it's a bit like what they say in American sports, like the big show is the top league, if you like, and there is a step up no matter what you say. But going back to, in terms of, you know, what the point you were making around the managers, I'd have no issue in seeing managers being paid, because for all the reasons that Peter just described there. But I would say the reality of it actually is that along with all of the other jobs that we describe for managers, I'd imagine most inter-county managers in Ireland spend an amount of their time actually fundraising for the operation of their squads.
Yeah, which adds to it. Well, this weekend we have the under-20 hurling final, and Peter Tipp will be on like a wave going into it, and huge support, is it, when they take on Cork.
Yeah, I remember in 2010 when this bunch won their first senior All-Ireland. There was five guys on both teams, Paddy Maher, Bonner Maher, Mickey Cahill, Brendan Maher and Noel McGrath. They were all on the two teams. And 6 days later, they played in an All-Ireland under 21, as it was. It's a year younger now, final in Thurles. I don't know if you were there that night.
I wasn't there. No.
It was mental. It was just, even before the start, they had it won, if you know what I mean. There was 21,000 people there, which is a huge crowd on a Saturday night for an under-20 final. And the place was red hot. They got two goals in the first 2 minutes, and it was just a parade then. They absolutely hammered Galway side, managed by Anthony Cunningham. And it was just an incredible night to be there. And of course, as we spoke earlier, the feeling was Tipperary people were like, we are going to dominate hurling, this team, we are going places. And of course, they didn't win a senior for 6 years, and they didn't win an under 21 for 8 years. So as you're pointing out, A doesn't necessarily follow B, but it was just it was really enjoyable occasion to be part of. And it's going to be interesting to see now, will the Tip people turn out again to support their own? I know it's a bit further down the road in Limerick, but I expect a big crowd, because it's
only just down the road.
Yeah. It depends on where you are. It's a hurling mad county. They're on a high at the moment, so I expect a big Tip crowd there. So I don't know, have the people of Cork got behind?
I think that we'll chat about it, but isn't it the case also, just to stick with the Tip rating for a minute, that Emma, you'll have the man or woman whose kids, they couldn't afford to bring them to Croke Park or whatever, and this is a chance now to go to an All-Ireland final and still be part of that buzz. So that'll ensure the crowd is big from Tip.
Absolutely, and like, I'd imagine the mood down in Tipperary is pretty outrageous at the minute, obviously after the homecoming and visiting the clubs and whatnot during the week. So it's just, I suppose, keeping that good mood going. And as you say, look, there could be families that couldn't afford to head to Croker, because, you know, the ticket prices have been pretty astronomical. And, you know, head over to the Gaelic Grounds on Saturday evening, what more could you want? I think the rivalry there is very interesting between Tip and Cork at that age level, because obviously it's a repeat of last year's final, it's a repeat of the Munster final, which Tip both won quite late. So Cork really do kind of owe them one. And is it a case of third time lucky? I don't know. What do you think, Donalog?
Yeah, I'm hoping obviously, but I like, whilst there isn't the party atmosphere, obviously, in Cork at the moment that there is in Tipperary, I would say that there's no less desire and hunger for an All-Ireland title. And, you know, it's the mid to late 90s since Cork have won an under-21. You correctly point out that they're back to that fine margins, like the All-Ireland final, and it's not taking anything away from Tipperary, but the All-Ireland final last year was fine margins. We know what happened in the Munster final a couple of weeks ago, and just hopefully, you know, the way games can turn on a dime is that saying, hopefully that if there are any breaks to be got this Saturday, that it'll be going in Cork's direction. And I expect a huge crowd to attend from Cork, and hopefully match anything.
Yeah, all twisted with bitterness at the thought of Tip winning.
Does Cork hurling need a bit of a boost at the moment? Obviously the season, senior season, ended the way it did, and you're on the hunt for a new manager as well, and Tipperary, your neighbour's obviously going so well. Does Cork need a win? Would this be a big landmark win for them, do you think, if they could get it over the line?
A win would be great for Cork, Peter. Do you know what I mean? There's no denying that. Like, it's like we said, it's been too long since we won an under-21. I know we've been winning a lot of we've won a number of, we'll say, the younger age groups over the last number of years, but in reality a lot of those were tournaments. Do you know what I mean? I wouldn't say that they were on, that you could compare any of them to a minor or an under-20 victory. So yes, it would be goes without saying, a very welcome boost on Saturday for us to win.
Yeah, they'll be huge interested and be live on Saturday Sport. We'll chat about the other big event of the weekend, the ladies football semi-finals in Croke Park, in a moment. But just before Dunlough, we leave you. The football has a 3-week gap between the semi-finals and the final. So Dublin and Kerry putting in that time after the weekend. How used you cope with that? How did you find that gap between the semi-final and coping with the excitement and drama and buzz? Is it a long time to kill?
There is a certain amount of it, Des. You know, like I think there's a fair amount of side shows go on, but side shows that you almost need to embrace, because it is, you know, it's just part and parcel of the GA, and if everything from, you know, people putting up flags around the town. There'll be, you know, everywhere you go, all of these players are amateurs. They'll be meeting people who want to talk about the game. Tickets, don't have to tell any yourselves. But, like, you know, everybody thinks everybody else has got a load of tickets, right? But that's a big part of it. And I would say that, you know, like, I'd imagine even for a lot of those players who've experienced this before, they will have come up with ways of mastering it. And I always made the point is that, you know, mastering things like that is, and understanding how to manage them is every bit as much a skill as other aspects of the game, and as important that you get all of those things nailed down right and give yourself every opportunity. Sean O'Gahalpin was, I suppose, the most professional person in terms of his approach to the game that I ever met. And Sean O'Gahalpin is a very generous, outward behaving person, but he always made the point that you need to be selfish. Your job over this period of time is to make sure that you get to throw in with all of the boxes ticked and you ready to perform, which is the important thing on the field. So I would say that it's the older you would get and the better you get at it, Des, I think that, you know, and my only advice to players would be in this period is not to get caught up in the sideshows, but also to embrace the experience and to enjoy it as much as possible, because you might think it's going to come around every year, and maybe it feels that way for Dublin, but even for those Dublin players, it will end also.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, Dunlough. Do you think that is in favour then of Dublin? Some of these guys are looking at their seventh All-Ireland final, whereas most of these Kerry lads are looking at a first senior All-Ireland at least. Does that experience help? You know, you were through five of them, weren't you?
I think it does, Peter. Absolutely. And I do think, like, there's no question about it that Dublin playing so many games in Croke Park and having their routine so nailed down. I know we maybe look at it at a macro level and you see the teams arriving, but there's so much on an individual basis that players want to get right. And that familiarity of routine, that familiarity of, you know, places where you go, even timings, that is no doubt is an advantage to Dublin, because it does come down to fine margins in terms of the game, but in terms of your own preparation also, it does come down to fine margins to ensure that you are in a better place. So I would definitely say that is an advantage to Dublin in this case, Peter.
It was interesting the way Dublin won the semi-final the weekend and had their press conference on the Monday.
Literally 3 o'clock. Like,
get it out of the way and then the full on preparation on their own.
Yeah, and I suppose it's a bit easier for them to organise it because everyone is around and the media is in Dublin, whereas Kerry went on the Thursday, which is because you had to organise that. People had to organise a bit of a trek down. Most of the media, national media, is based in Dublin. But yeah, it was, as you say, we've done this before. We know what we're doing. Let's get everything we can out of the way as soon as we can. Let's get the media out of the way. So the media's gone. That's one less thing, you know. So then there's obviously tickets and suits and whatever else goes with it. But if you can get all the outside stuff out of the way as quick as possible and get concentrating on the matches, Dunlough says you just have to zero in and getting yourself in to Croke Park on the day is in best shape you can. Once you can get that stuff out of the way, and that's experience, I suppose, from Jim Gavin's perspective, so much the better.
Indeed. Okay, well, look, thanks, Dunlough, appreciate it.
I used to take the Tuesday and Wednesday as holiday days leading up to all the big games, and you know, even the people I used to be working for would be saying, you know, you'd imagine that you maybe take off the days closer to the game. But the reason I used to take off the Tuesday and the Wednesday was for exactly those reasons, just so you could just wipe everything, all of the loose ends. And even, like, you know, maybe there was a getting gear ready or hurleys or any of those last small little things that you would just have 2 days in the middle of the week that you would know I'm going to get everything wiped there, and that any of my thought time, any of my mindset is going to be free to focus on being ready for the game on Sunday evening.
We any good in work on the Thursday and the Friday to anybody?
Was I any good in work any day? Maybe, that's another day's question.
All right, it's fascinating. Thanks, Donal Logue. Well, look, at the other big occasion this weekend, Emma Duffy, is the All-Ireland football, ladies football semi-finals at Croke Park. And the fact that they've brought the double header to Croke Park was Hyde Park last year. So it's a big switch and a big move. Now, the final attracted 50,000 for the last 2 years. And ironically, there will be four teams this weekend, Galway, Mayo and Dublin Cork, and it's not going to attract anything like that. The wisdom of Croke Park, obviously it's good for everyone to get to play there. What's your view on it?
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose Donal Logue spoke about the familiarity.
We know what you're talking about.
That. Spoke about that, and that I think is quite a big thing going into Sunday. Look at Dublin and Cork. They've been dominating ladies football for the past many years, as many know. I think it was 2004 the last time a different team won it, and that was Galway. But in terms of these teams, look, Mayo were there in 2017, so they have that Croke Park experience. A few of them, I know they have a different panel compared to last year, obviously, with everything that happened. Dublin and Cork, though, they have it too, and they've played some league doubleheaders and stuff in the big stadium. Galway don't. Many of those Galway girls don't have that Croke Park experience. So I was speaking to Sinead Burke the other day, and she's been playing inter-county senior football for, I think, 12 years or so, and this will be her first time in Croke Park. That is big. But then you can look at it on the flip side. Look, it's another game of football, and girls just have to go out and do what they've done every other day on Sunday.
Yeah, what do you think of it, Peter?
Yeah, I think it's the right decision to put it in Croke Park, because as many players as possible should get the chance to play there, and it's great. They reckon the crowd could be 10,000 if it's a really good crowd on Sunday. It might even be less than that, which it just kind of shows you that there's still work to be done. The getting 50,000 for All Ireland finals is fantastic. It's a big day. It's on TV, and it shows you what the potential that's there. But if you're only getting 5,000-10,000 at your semi-finals, it's showing that a lot of people are just there for the final, for the occasion, you know, because there's four teams involved here, Dublin and Cork, big populations, successful teams in particular, the two best teams in the country for the last 15 years, as Emma said. So they should be well supported. But I suppose it just shows the LGFA, for all the good work they have done, is that they still have a bit to travel. And it's up to the public to get behind this as well. It's not just about players or standards or LGFA. People have to buy into this as well, because people who'll go to a men's semi-final won't necessarily go to a women's semi-final, and that's a choice. Why do they do that? And it's not to do with the product, because the game is good.
Oh, it's a very good game. Yeah. But Emma, what about that view? There's a push now. Camogie has set a target. We want 25,000 ladies football, 50,000. Is there a concern that with the 2020 campaign, this is starting building at the top and not building at the bottom? And would it be better to try and get 2,000 people to go to all the first round matches, you know, including Waterford, you know, Cavan, Mayo, Armagh, yeah, Donegal? Would that be a better target to aim at?
Absolutely, Jez. I think that is a big thing in ladies football. I think the focus is really on All-Ireland final day and getting that 50,000 crowd out. You know, 50,000 last year, 46,000 the year before, and that was hugely record shattering from the year before that. But the thing is, there's high quality games in the group stages and the round robin stages, then going into quarterfinals, semi-finals, that people are missing out on, and they don't really understand, I suppose, the narrative of the championship. You know, you're going in on All-Ireland final day, you don't realise that, okay, Donegal got knocked out in the group stages this year, that was massive, and things like that. I remember last year being down at the semi-final doubleheader. It was down in the Hyde and Roscommon.
I was at that too.
Yeah, absolutely. Two brilliant games of football. And I remember on the day people saying that there was 2,000-3,000 there. It came out this week that there was only 1,000. That's a doubleheader All-Ireland semi-final. And you're looking at the same in Croke Park on Sunday.
Mainly from Donegal, actually. It struck me
on
the day. Yeah,
absolutely. And that's the thing, though. On Sunday, they're targeting 10,000, as Peter said. But, you know, we're in a really, really busy few weeks of between the men's football, the hurling, the camogie, the ladies' football. You know, there's a lot of weekends for families to be on the go every weekend to go to matches. I do think for the players it's great. Obviously, every player wants to play in Croke Park and deserves to play in Croke Park in my eyes. That is a massive step, and it is nice, I suppose, to be taking the focus away from All-Ireland Final Day. But as you say, it might be better to kind of go from the bottom up instead.
Yeah. Peter, the games see Galway and Mayo in the opening game and then Dublin and Cork. And a lot of people are looking on the Dublin Cork game as
the All-Ireland Final.
Well, yeah, I was wondering how to phrase it, but the winners will come from that.
Yeah, it's hard not to look at it that way, and we could be sitting here in a couple of weeks' time going, yeah, God, yeah, Galway were nailed on All-Ireland champions. We said that. But look, they've won every All-Ireland since 2004, between them Cork 11 and Dublin 3. They've contested most of the big prizes the last couple of years. It is hard to see past them actually winning it, because both Mayo and Galway are relatively inexperienced. Galway haven't won one since 2004. Mayo haven't won one since God only knows when, and they have largely got a new squad of players following last year's walkout as well. So,
but there's a familiarity there between the two. There's that word again, between Galway and Mayo, isn't there?
In both semi-finals,
yeah.
Actually.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's great. Like, we've two massive rivalries. Obviously, Dublin and Cork is probably acknowledged as the biggest national modern-day rivalry in ladies football. But then you look at Mayo and Galway and that local rivalry. You know, they're meeting in Connacht every year, and it's massive battles. Galway are coming out on top the majority of the time, but like, Mayo are fascinating to watch. You never know what's going to happen. Like, you look at the last...
Their match with Donegal, which was an extraordinary
unbelievable
game.
Unbelievable. Yeah. And like, that is a huge, huge boost for Mayo going forward. Not just that they beat Donegal, but that they actually knocked them out of the competition. Like, that's massive. And you look at Mayo the last 2 years and the roller coaster ride they've been on, you know, from being in an All-Ireland final in 2017 to the walkout last summer. They actually were in a league final last year. You nearly forget that. And look, that they're back in an All-Ireland semi-final is massive. Galway, on the other hand, you know, they seem to kind of always fall at the semi-final hurdle, the last hurdle, and it's the question of, can they get over the line this time around?
Do you think they can?
I think that one's going to be a really, really tough one to call. I feel that watching Galway this year, yeah, there's kind of a new kind of confidence about them. Tim Rabbitt has come in and as manager, and he's brought real professionalism to the setup and built on the work that's gone before him. And yeah, I think that, look, they're in better stead this year to do it than any other year beforehand, but you never know what's going to happen with Mayo.
Mayo have lost Roisin Flynn as well, haven't they?
Yeah,
their fullback, which is
but Danielle Caldwell has come in and she was phenomenal the last day against Armagh. She was absolutely brilliant.
What about Dublin and Cork? Dublin in recent years got a brief upper hand.
Finally, because you know, Cork had their one of the most unprecedented spells of dominance in sport. They won, was it
11 and 12,
9 in a row, and they beat Dublin a lot of times along those ways, and Dublin had some heartbreaking final defeats. I think their first ever win over Cork was in the 17 final. So yeah, they have that upper hand, they have that bit of experience. They're going for 3 in a row, which would be a remarkable achievement considering they've only won 3 All-Irelands to date. Cork, most of their greats have retired, so, but they seem to have come through that transition phase. They won the league with a bit of style this year. They beat Dublin in the semi-final after extra time, which was a big thing for them.
Massive game.
It was a great game, absolutely unbelievable game. Dublin probably thought they had won at a point as well, but the fact that they beat Dublin and did it the hard way is a huge boost for them. Sinead Goldrick and Dearne O'Sullivan, two of the best players in either team, were missing that semi-final, so that's going to add something to it this weekend. It's a hard one. Like, there's kind of a feeling that Dublin haven't hit their best yet this year, but they've run up some really big totals: 5-15 against Kerry, 3-20 against Monaghan, 5-15 against Waterford. If they've a bit to go on top of that, you know, they'll take a lot of stopping.
I think Dublin on Sunday, definitely. I think Dublin need to pull a consistent performance out of the bag. We haven't really seen it so far this championship from them. You know, they've had slow starts in first halves and then put teams away in the second, but I think on Sunday they need to be on their A game to get across Cork. I think Cork are going to be coming into this one nicely. You know, you can't forget that they were beaten by Armagh on the group stages by a point, and that was a massive, massive win for Armagh. But Cork won't mind. You know, they bounced back the week after and put up huge scorelines again. their forward line is absolutely amazing. Like, you look at Darren O'Sullivan, as you say, and Sinead Goldrick, that's an interesting matchup, I think. You look at Ciara O'Sullivan, who's been there for years, and she's just the epitome of class. Orla Finn, who kind of puts up these amazing scores, you know, she's hitting double digits in matches but just going under the radar because she's tipping over frees. Saoirse Noonan, Emer Scally. It's important, like, it's really interesting to see who will actually start, what will be Cork's forward line on Sunday. And with Dublin as well, their inside forwards are deadly. Sinead O'Hearn, you know, one of the best in the country, and they actually haven't had their six forwards, like, the, you know, their first choice forward line start
they've
together.
They've had a lot of injuries,
absolutely. So I do think it will be a huge, huge game on Sunday. It's a fascinating rivalry, but I actually think if I was to tip someone, I think I'd go with Cork.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, well, I have to say the final last year was one of the most enjoyable games of women's football I've seen. It was so intense, something we hadn't really seen, and really physical game as well.
This is exactly going to be
the same. I don't know, maybe it's heart over head almost, but I think Dublin just that bit of experience. But yeah, this Cork team isn't far away from beating Dublin and you know, starting to knock off all Ireland's again, I think.
Definitely not, and they're not going anywhere, like, you know. They have a very young team, and the obviously Dublin are gonna, you know, pay no heed to the pressure. But there is that big thing of three in a row, and, you know, the old enemy in the semi final to get over, and to get over first is huge.
That's true. Like, we're actually talking about it, like, it is an all our final the way we were talking about that last couple of minutes. It's important to remember that it is a semi final.
No disrespect to Galway Mayo, and you can hear both games live on Sunday Sport, of course, here on RT Radio. Well, look, that's it for this week from the RTGA podcast. Thanks to Peter Sweeney, to Emma Duffy and Don Lowe-Cusack. We'll be back next week looking ahead to Dublin versus Kerry in the football final.